In the 121st Block Talks, we speak with Guerra, crypto founder in residence at OnAfrique, who tells us why crypto needs Africa. I'm your host, Mauricio Magaldi, and this is Block Drops, your weekly digest on blockchain for business. These news are not a form of endorsement, sponsorship, or encouragement for consumption, and are meant for educational purposes only. All right, everybody, I'm here with Guerra, who's going to tell us who she is and what she does with blockchain. Guerra, it's such a pleasure to have you on Block Talks. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Mauricio. This is exciting. And also, wow, I can't believe it's finally the time has come. I've been listening to the podcast for a little bit. I've known you for a lot of time. I've also worked with you, miss having you as my boss, but yeah, it's doing okay. I am the founder in residence for crypto at an African payments company. So it's called, our name is OnAfrique. We recently changed our name. Our name was previously MFS Africa, but as of at the end of last year, we've recently changed our name to OnAfrique, which is a very exciting new name. Ona is the Yoruba word for pathways. And Afrique with a Q is a nod to the diversity of Africa, which also includes Francophone Africa. So even though my French pas très bon, my French is not so great, but I do have a lot of love and respect for Francophone Africa. So what do we do on Afrique? We are the largest payments gateway in Africa. So what does that mean? We basically have built a network of across the continent of what people maybe in the West might call alternative payment methods, but we actually, alternative payment methods are the main payment method. So mobile money is really our bread and butter. So we have made mobile money interoperable across 40 countries lots and lots of other corridors for remittances, but also for enterprise payments, enabling companies like the likes of Spotify to collect payments, all the way through to some crypto exchanges that work with us right now to collect and disperse, so on and off ramp for them as well. So OnAfrique also, when I say Africa's largest payments gateway, we also have a cards business. So we are the largest prepaid card issuer processor on the continent, working with a bunch of banks and fintechs as well. And we also, in Nigeria, have an agent network called Baxi. So Baxi is an agent network of 300,000 agents across Nigeria who offer agency banking services. So like everything from cash in, cash out to airtime, selling, utility, bill payment, all sorts of things, cash services as well. So that's OnAfrique in a nutshell. And yeah, I guess, what do I do? So my title is quite interesting. You take a step back and look at the company OnAfrique and you're like, okay, where does crypto fit in? Crypto fits into every really product offering that we offer. So if I could break it down by the verticals that we think of, so we've got our agent services, which is Baxi. We've got our network, which is the network of 40 countries, 500 million mobile money wallets, a couple hundred million bank accounts as well that we connect across the continent. So that's our network. Cards is a big piece of what we do. And then we also have the fin part of the business. So fin in fintech, which encompasses our FX business and our OTC business as well. So when any payments company with a healthy cross-border element to it must have a bit of a OTC FX trading part of the side of the business. So that's all of those areas. I'll list them again. Crypto really touches them. So that's our network, our card space, our agent services, and our finance part of the business. So I joined the company about a year and a half ago now, in a very vague role. So my title is the founder in residence for crypto. The word founder is quite important here because I came into really not much crypto exploration had been done by the business. So kind of picking things up from scratch. And that's the exciting dynamic product side of things and partnerships all the way through to what I would actually think is quite exciting still, but most people might think is boring, but compliance, risk, and legal. So really preparing a large business like Onafreak to really catch the wave for new digital money and how that's going to affect Africa.
That's not a small sized dish, I'll tell you that. Now, your story doesn't start here. And once you and I met, we had a, you know, quite a few, you know, cuppas, and I think we traded a lot of chops around, you know, our both of our backgrounds in crypto. How and when did crypto come into your life, and when was the moment you had that epiphany of like, ah, this is it?
Yeah, definitely. I think to give some context, you and I crossed paths when we worked together at 11FS within the consulting team. We built out the crypto advisory arm of the business, which was really exciting. And honestly, what a privilege and honor to have worked with you and to, you know, still cross paths and still share. I think one thing that you and I have in common, you coming from Brazil, myself coming from East Africa and with a passion for African payments in general. There's a lot that both the fields in which we're you know, passionate about can learn from each other. So Latin America and Africa. But what led me to crypto? I guess I'll start with a bit of an overview of my career in general. And this is, you know, 11FS was really maybe the first time in my life, in my career, where I got paid to think about crypto and really do crypto in general, like to get paid to do it, which, you know, I never ever thought that would happen. So my crypto story starts like way back, you know, right after I graduated university, and this thing called Bitcoin was bouncing around. And basically, I got gifted it by someone, which, you know, don't want to think too much about how much those Bitcoins would be now, but I got gifted Bitcoin by an unpaid internship I had. So my boss at the time was, you know, felt really bad. He really liked the work that I did, but he was like, I got to pay you somehow. Here's this thing, this USB with some things called Bitcoin. And I think at the time, all I could buy was guns and drugs online. So I really kind of forgot about it and kept plugging away with my career. And my really first encounter with the power of Bitcoin was when I founded my own startup. So my first ever venture was a cross-border payments company to do remittances back and forth, so to Africa and from Africa to Canada, so between Kenya, Uganda, and Canada. And bootstrapped a little bit of that with some Bitcoin that I had. But also at the time, you know, Bitcoin was the market was rallying slightly, was pulling back slightly. It was very scary, exciting times, but it was still a thing that only really people in the small communities that we were in knew about. A lot of those people maybe who were prominent at the time maybe might be in prison now or on the run. But it was definitely like a crazy time. So my first venture, like I said, was cross-border payments, but I was quite young. I didn't really know anything about cross-border payments, didn't really know anything about fintech. I didn't even know the word fintech at all, but learned a lot in that process and in that venture, and unfortunately had to, you know, wind down. And we realized, thankfully, early on, about a year and a half in, that this wasn't going to work, or at least we were a little bit too early for the product that we wanted to build. So I decided to move on and move into the world of fintech for real, and looked around and saw this up and coming. This card, this fancy colored card in the UK that everyone was raving about called Monzo. And I joined when it was a prepaid card, and we were a pretty small team at the time. And let's just say I learned a lot while I was there and left when the company had about 1,000 employees and about 4 million customers at the time I'd left. So joining very early on and leaving when it was, you know, I think it's Series E. And that was an experience unlike any other. So building a bank from scratch. So during that time, we obtained a banking license. I learned a lot about engaging with regulators. I learned a lot about financial crime. I learned a lot about product as well. And really just like building something from scratch, like card schemes, everything like that. And from there, I went into consulting. And that's where I landed at 11FS and basically did the same thing that I did at Monzo. You know, building and scaling on behalf of our clients. But while I was there, again, the thread throughout my entire career has been crypto, really. So in the background, was, you know, had exposure, was buying and holding and playing around with Bitcoin, really, and other tokens. Ethereum was on the rise. Was kind of obsessed with various white papers coming out, and during DeFi summer of during the pandemic, I really got stuck in. So that's really where I said, okay, I've got all this time, and you know, what else am I doing if I'm stuck at home? I might as well start poking around, and got into Web3 gaming, learned a lot about, you know, various token projects, and fell in love with, you know, ENS and even DAOs in general as well. And that was the beginning of really when I was just starting to get actually engaged, and didn't really see this as no longer as just like a means of investment or really I wasn't watching the lines on the graphs go up. And things really changed and struck something with me when I discovered stablecoins. So stablecoins, we know USDC and USDT, and now we've even got PYUSD, and there's all sorts of other stablecoins that exist, good and bad. And that was, for me, a light bulb moment where I, as someone who has been in regulated financial services environments, thought, okay, maybe this is where my experience and my passion, my expertise and my passion will intersect. And, you know, looking just purely at the numbers, you know, I was deep in DeFi, and, you know, just every week, every month, there was things coming out or news or information that I was learning that just was affirming my path. So, you know, there was this report from the World Bank that concluded that DeFi is a lot more cost efficient and efficient in general than traditional financial services. And moving, you know, I played my hand at moving. At this time, I was living between London and Nairobi, and I was sending myself money every, when I was living in Kenya, every week or so, using traditional payment rails, which was just so expensive and so slow, that I started using crypto and using various P2P exchanges to withdraw my money. And that was also like another light bulb moment. So when I joined OnAfreak, that's when I really have doubled down again on the African continent and on working in the global South. And this was when it's all clicked. Financial services is far from being done, really, in I guess the, you know, the global North, but in Africa and specifically, it's, you know, we haven't even really begun to see what efficient and equitable even financial services can do for our populations and for what's going on in the continent. So that for me has been a bit of a life changer. And yes, you know, throughout the crypto winter, it was difficult to remain optimistic and you know, with all, you know, various, Terra Luna and FTX and all the things that had got, you know, me very excited and about the prospects of this stuff. But I think, you know, the winter was a really, really good time. Also, you know, joining this large financial services company was a really great sobering experience to kind of also come out the other end, which I still am bullish and excited about the prospect of digital money for the future of Africa.
We kind of stem from the same place in the sense that we were both in financial services. We come from Global South, and we had this first run in with, you know, the specific technology that requires nothing else other than just, you know, a computer with internet access. And it can change how people relate with money, which is probably the core use case for crypto and blockchains in general. And it's hard to argue, you know, against that. Now, your experience is very peculiar in a way that you've done a lot of different things in your career, or better said, you've approached the same problem from a variety of angles, right? Because you're in financial services. From your experience, both recent and longer time, what were the use cases that you felt were like, okay, yeah, this has legs to stand on, this can actually become an industry, you know, in and on itself, in the context of the markets in Africa that you have firsthand experience with?
I guess I'll look at it from a couple of different opportunities that I saw that I saw as like, and I think I was always thinking, I think most crypto people, and I guess me as well in the beginning, was very wanting, you know, anti-establishment, wanting to break the banks and destroy traditional financial services. And I still do to an extent, but I also recognize the importance of collaborating and working with existing systems to basically, you know, bring them forward, and also whilst innovating and that. But really, number one is, and this is kind of the theme that drives it all, is exposure for the Global South, so Africa in general, exposure to global markets. So first of all, from a speculative perspective, it is near impossible for someone in, you know, say Nigeria or Cameroon to buy Tesla stock or to buy an ETF, you know, traditional financial tools that basically will enable them to you know, grow their money or save their money. It's really difficult to actually find to get access to that. So Bitcoin was the answer for a lot of people. People were able to, you know, a lot of people made their lives off of Bitcoin. There's a huge generation that really was able to pull themselves and their families out of poverty by investing purely in cryptocurrency. The second, I would say, is when I say access to the global financial market, is cross-border payments, right? So there was a stat, you know, that came out a couple years ago around that looked at cross-border flows between Africa and you know, outside of Africa. So everyone really only looked at flows into Africa, so remittances or aid or whatever. And this stat actually, you know, was quite shocking for me. So basically, about 30%, and this is back in 2021, I believe I can share the source of the with you, but a report was found by the Brookings Institute that about 30% of outflows from Africa were going to East Asia. So also known, you know, China, really. So China and its growing influence and relationships, like ties with Africa, has resulted in a need for, you know, very seamless payment flows between these two regions. And this is like trade, essentially. This is like the backbone of really every economy is trade. And crypto is something that unlocked that. So stablecoins specifically, like USDT, enabling, you know, say a bulk importer of farming equipment in Nigeria is able to pay his supplier in China using stablecoins. And this is something that it's a theme that still exists today. Even at Onafreak, we have a whole line of our business which is dedicated to flows between Africa and Asia. So that's the other side. So two within one theme of unlocking the, you know, global markets to Africa. Number one is investment. Number two is trade, and then number three, really, I would say, is also just flows going in. So Africa, you know, is a region that is poised to grow quite rapidly already. But one of our biggest exports is our labor. So whilst, yes, we're seeing, you know, right now we're seeing a huge flows of human capital going to regions like the GCC region. So, you know, the UAE, Qatar, folks are going to go and send money home oftentimes. But we're also seeing a growth of labor on the ground in Africa still as well. So with growing technology adoption, increasing rates of education, we're seeing people with you know, knowledge in gig work, people who are able to do gig work. So everything ranging from virtual assistants all the way through to you know, software engineers, people who are able to code and also make money from doing this, these things online. So platforms like Upwork growing in their reliance on African labor, needing to pay people. So this is another way that the global economy is opened up to Africa. So these are all things that I think are like are really where crypto has found its product market fit. I'd also add one other thing. With that, you know, the access to the world. I think one other thing is the world's access to Africa, right? So, like I said, with labor, but you know, there's a famous quote from this guy named Yosef Ayele. He's a community builder and Web3 community leader. He connects various communities around the world to Africa, and he has this very famous quote that he said at I think it was Consensus 2 years ago, where he said, "Africa doesn't need crypto; crypto needs Africa." And that statement was so powerful. I think it goes to show that this is where the global South, like, you know, I'd say Argentina, Brazil, and Africa as well, is where crypto has found its product market fit. This is a region where we don't have reliable financial services or systems. Even at Onafreak, this company's been around 14 years, and we're only now just really starting to connect the very hyper fragmented patchwork that exists of the African payments ecosystem. So crypto is something that is doing that already. We've got lots of developers growing on the continent. It's really fascinating, but it's also important to note that crypto and blockchain in general is something that new technology that came to the world all at once, right? There was no hierarchical way of it being trickled down to the world. There's no, not like, for example, AI is probably the one thing we can all think about. AI, you know, we still think about Silicon Valley when we think of AI innovation. But with crypto and blockchain, you know, Bitcoin was invented and boom, then and there, anyone with an internet connection a bit of knowledge about coding can do stuff, right? So it's the first time ever, and I can say this quite confidently, ever in modern history, where a technology has reached Africa at the same time as it got to everywhere else. So it's been quite interesting to see the divergence of how adoption has happened. So looking in the West, where adoption is mostly focused on the speculative aspect of it, right? So, you know, looking like the way I enter crypto, like looking at the line going up on the graph, whereas now it's like looking at how Africans are using crypto, which is, again, more utility focused. So cross-border payments, remittances, trade in general, and there's way more coming as well. And a lot, like, it's, you know, we haven't even seen the tip, you know, the beginning of it, because there's so many other problems that can be solved, like identity, for example, in Africa. So there's, I'm very excited and very bullish for the future of blockchain and crypto in Africa.
Yeah, I think the great point is the ability for quantum leap, right? You go from not having, you know, paper records to be in a mobile nation or mobile region, right? And then you have this ancient financial services sector that can go from, you know, brick and mortar offices to being completely on chain, right? This the ability of just leaping over generations of technologies that we've seen in Africa is also remarkable, of the ability to capture and capitalize on some of these opportunities. But not everything, you know, comes easy, especially in the global South. So I would imagine that there is a lot of lots of challenges that are very particular to the region. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a glance into what are the very typical things that countries in Africa have faced while trying to integrate crypto into their daily lives, and how are they tackling those?
The biggest challenge is at the point of on and off ramp. So that is something that still remains, I think globally, it remains to be a struggle. And, you know, we've definitely seen the rise of centralized exchanges, like Coinbase and Binance, like globally solve for this and, you know, rightfully so as well, become regulated, because they are the front door to crypto. The way we've seen this, you know, because regulation is still lagging, and I mean, as of like last month, Nigeria is starting to regulate, for example. But one way I've seen developers and people in our ecosystem get around it is P2P networks. So P2P networks have been the backbone of crypto adoption in Africa, because it's just quite rare and quite difficult for traditional financial services companies to on and off ramp people. And, you know, we saw the rise of Paxful. Paxful, you know, now no longer open, but Paxful did a lot of heavy lifting back in the day to enable P2P people to on and off ramp into crypto. And that was something that was, you know, unheard of at the time. Binance, to this day, some of Binance's largest volumes in Africa is still P2P. So P2P is kind of the way that we've seen liquidity move on chain in Africa. Another challenge would be regulation, right? So with regulation, there's not really a way to get around it. It's just, I mean, there's ways you can get around it, but not at scale. And it resulted in a lot of, you know, horrible and disappointing things happen, like various scams. You know, famously, we've seen world, you know, I think OneCoin, which was many years ago, which targeted African populations. But because there was no firm regulation in place. But now we're starting to see, like, how are we getting around it now? So, or how are we getting, instead of around, how are we getting through it? Nigeria has just released some guidelines around for exchanges and how they engage with the on-off ramps, so basically banks. We're seeing the rise of some very well-organized consortiums and lobbying groups who are very thoughtfully engaging with regulators in Kenya, South Africa, Botswana, you know, various countries, DRC even. So this is, I think maybe this time next year, I won't be saying this, maybe this time next year, I'll be bragging about all the wonderful regulation that we were able to benefit from. But yeah, those are kind of maybe the two things that that come to mind.
Yeah, I feel that the regulatory landscape is maybe starting to get a little bit more stable, in a sense that there is, one, the application of pre-existing regulations to cases that are tangential to crypto. And you've heard me say this before. I think that FTX is a non-crypto fraud case. Crypto was the asset class of choice because they're not even using the technology to do, you know, actual accounting of, you know, the funds and everything. So I think that is kind of one example. And then obviously there is more clarity, even if it's not what I would call ideal regulation, there is more clarity in countries like Singapore, Brazil, the UK is working on it, Europe with Mika. And obviously there is an expectation that the US, being who they are, will also tackle this in a more professional manner, right? Not just regulation by litigation, right? So I think that is obviously a scenario in Africa, being, you know, many countries with different takes of different local realities, have been also a wide variety of crypto friendly to anti-crypto, which, by the way, if you guys don't know, that is the both ends of the Guerra gradient, where we grade the appetite for crypto of a particular institution or individual. So that is a very useful. Go read the literature if you haven't. So it's pretty awesome. So yeah, there's all sorts of of countries in the Guerra gradient. From your experience, what are those that are more crypto friendly, and what are those that are less crypto friendly on the other end of the Guerra gradient? And maybe if you can elaborate a little bit of why you think that these countries are not as friendly or as friendly as they are in the current context.
So I'd say Kenya, for example, is on the extreme side of not friendly. And it's not for lack of understanding from regulators. Like, I'd say people underestimate how smart and engaged regulators are. I think it's, first of all, the Kenyan shilling is rapidly devaluing. It's macroeconomic situation is just not great, and that's really hitting Kenya quite heavily. So the government, or I guess the central bank, is focused on that. But again, the lobbying groups are doing quite well. And it goes to show in how they're regulating crypto, how they're approaching regulating crypto. Like, there's a bill that they're trying to bring in, which is to tax crypto quite aggressively. And that just goes to show a very haphazard attempt to regulate. I'd say on the other side, is probably more recently on the other side, is Nigeria. So Nigeria, as of December 22nd, I know the exact date because it was my last day of work before I logged off for the holidays. But December 22nd of 2023, the Nigerian regulator, the Central Bank of Nigeria, released some very, very clear guidelines on how crypto entities should obtain licensing and engage with banks. And this is something that I think was really well timed, but also well received by the whole ecosystem. You wouldn't believe, my holiday didn't start maybe till the 26th of December, because every day from there I was receiving all these calls and messages, people just very excited about what's coming next and curious about what we're doing in this space as Wana Freak. So I also want to outline something. So with regards to regulation, so whilst, yes, Nigeria has taken really bold step to regulate, especially centralized crypto exchanges, this has shown, first of all, that they can balance innovation and maturity, right, with thoughtful regulation. But let's take a step back and look at the wider picture. So Nigeria is it's a country that has dabbled in crypto already. They've released a CBDC called the eNaira, which hasn't performed well. But it just goes to show that they've made slow and steady efforts to actually start to regulate the space. But when I say take a step back and look at the wider picture, Nigeria is on the FATF list. So what does FATF stand for? FATF is the Financial Action Task Force. It's a global multi-organization entity body that basically regulates and monitors countries at the country level, so central bank level, around financial crime, anti-money laundering, and all that, terrorist financing, all that. So they have this list called the gray list. So the gray list is kind of, if you think about, at Christmas, Santa has the naughty list. The gray list is the naughty list in a sense, right? It's who they deem to be slightly risky, and there's all sorts of ways that they measure this. This is publicly available how it's measured, and being on the gray list is not great. It's not fun at all. There's lots of various sanctions. I mean, there's also the complete, I think it's a red list, a block list. I can't remember the name, but there's a list as well where, and this is really where Russia is on this list. Countries like, excuse me, North Korea is on that list, but the gray list is kind of between good and bad. Or well-behaved and bad-behaved. And there's various countries on the gray list right now. I'm just going to try and figure out who else is on that gray list. So right now on the gray list, we've got Haiti, Zimbabwe, South Africa, I believe, is still on the gray list. Nigeria, there's quite a few. And these are countries who are, they're basically being given the chance to get off the gray list. And there's all sorts of things that they can do to do this. There's all sorts of measures that they can take. But one thing that they can do, which the FATF, FATF has outlined, is to regulate crypto. So they've actually released pretty clear guidelines as well, the FATF, on global regulation of crypto to tackle money laundering and terrorist financing. So the Nigerian regulator coming out with regulation is not just to advance the ecosystem. No, not because the Central Bank of Nigeria is staffed with DGENs. It's because there's a wider, bigger play here, and it is to help. One of the things they want to do with this is to help Nigeria get off that gray list, is to prove that we can actually regulate this new technology and, oversee the regulation of it in a way that the use is not in a malicious way.
Interesting take. Yeah, I think one of the kind of indications that these are getting normalized in some countries, the fact that recently the Central Bank of Nigeria actually accepted a Naira stablecoin as part of their regulatory sandbox for digital finance. So this is like significant progress versus things that happened a couple of years ago, especially with the banks trying to debank crypto businesses and things like that. So I think it's interesting to see. I don't think it's an accommodation. I think it's just the realization that this technology has been here for a while and it continues to be here despite of what humans do. It continues to produce blocks every 10 seconds. So I think it's some of those things that if you're a smart regulator, you're going to start realizing that, yep, this can be very beneficial for us as regulators as well. Let's try and see what, you know, where that ends. Now, in terms of a newcomer for this industry, be it an investor, a product person, a founder, a curious person, or a developer, you know, just pick a persona, and what would you recommend they pay attention to and the resources they can tap for learning?
So I mean, I don't want to plug my own podcast, but I also have a podcast called Crypto at Scale. Which is under, we released it under the Flip Africa, which is a media house.
Yes, you can.
So we're about to launch season two, where we talk more about this, and we talk really mostly with builders on the ground, about what they're working on. So that's the first place. I would also recommend, looking at what large traditional financial services companies in Africa are doing with regards to crypto. Most of the big ones, and I'm not going to name them, but if you could think of, you know, when it comes to mobile money, when it comes to payments, there's a few pan-African entities that are starting to basically invest in, and not just invest in the sense of like hiring the head of crypto, but invest in using crypto in the back end. So that's one thing. I think definitely regulated entities are who to talk to about this kind of stuff. I'd look to some of our homegrown exchanges. They have a lot of really great, relevant and market specific information about crypto adoption in Africa. So Yellow Card, I would say, is one. Yellow Card has done a really great job of growing across the continent. They've been one of the first, the first exchange to obtain a license in in Botswana. And I believe their CEO was quoted at the end of last year that he will be going after a license in Nigeria. So I like to look at the homegrown, players and how they're approaching it. Twitter, X. X is kind of like the place that everyone, you know, it can be like crypto Twitter, which I think is still called crypto Twitter. It's not going to ever be called crypto X, but crypto Twitter is quite loud and obnoxious. But African crypto Twitter is definitely loud and obnoxious as well. But there's a lot of really great conversations going on, especially around regulation in Nigeria. So those are some places I would point people to. Oh yeah, and then sorry, one last thing. Emergo, who are an investment. And also, so basically they're part of the Cardano blockchain, or the Cardano Foundation, and Emergo is, they basically support adoption of crypto across Africa, and they've been doing quite a lot of investment in the space. They're definitely, a great place to look. And then if I was to point at, layer ones or layer twos, I'd point at Celo. CELO. Celo blockchain is probably the most visible and active layer one on the continent. Africa meshes quite well with their ethos, which is mobile first, and Africa is a mobile first market. And then an L2 that comes to mind is Base. So Coinbase is L2 built on Ethereum. They are making very concerted efforts to engage with and work with builders in Africa. So those are two other areas I'd say to look at.
Nice. No, these are all good references. Another deep one. So for us to avoid a scenario where we work on this industry for yet another 20 years and then look in hindsight and figure out that we didn't solve the problems we thought we would solve, what is the one thing that we need to pay attention to and do it like now?
I'm curious also to hear your opinion, but I'll give mine. And I think it's something that, you know, I think we struggle with in Africa, like I think, which is not looking to the West for inspiration or for permission. Like I said, this is the first time technology has come to us at the same time as everyone else. I'd warn builders on the continent to, like, I think we need more homegrown success stories. And to build more home, and there's definitely some that are in the works right now, but I'd say, yeah, definitely, you know, we shouldn't wait for insert name of famous centralized exchange or insert name of famous crypto founder to come and give us permission to do cool things. I think we should do them ourselves. But what would you say?
You're trying to Uno card my question. That is not fair.
I'm curious about what you would say, actually. I mean, maybe not for Africa, but like for the global South in general.
This is not about me.
But your thoughts are always so interesting.
It's not about me. But anyway, I'll give you my two cents on that. So I have a theory that for us to make this like reality, it has to be adopted quite, you know, openly and quite broadly by society. And not just in financial services cases or money related, but in how we deal with our data, right? I think that is a lot that we don't know about our data and how data and our data is used both in our favor and against us, right? And I think blockchains are a great way for us to do that as a society. But for us to get there, there's three things I feel we need to fix. One is UX. Right. Right now we're touching the blockchain and we shouldn't. Self-sovereignty is for people who are really, really well equipped technically. And most of us aren't. So I think we need to understand how to find a sweet spot UX for data ownership. Includes money, but more generic data ownership. The second is education. If you see across, especially the global South, the context is enormous financially and socially. But if you go and if you dig deeper into those differences and the context, the source of that contrast is usually educational in all angles. So I think as a society, for us to do better use of our data and do better, you know, make better use of technology in general, we need to be better educated. So I think that is important. And the third thing is when it comes to things like digital assets, we have to have the regulators becoming a part of the infrastructure. And until that happens, they're going to be two different things. One is a regulation written on a website somewhere. And the other one is what's programmed on the blockchain as a protocol, as a policy. And these things cannot exist in separate realms. They need to be one and the same. So I feel that these are the three things that we have to look now and solve now. And I know I ask everybody in my show, what's the one thing? I did this exercise multiple times. I wrote about it and I can't boil it down to just one. So these are my three things.
I would argue that those three things are kind of starting to happen. So like let's just randomly pick Nigeria again. You know, with regards to UX, who is solving for that? Exchanges. So centralized exchanges are solving for that right now. Let's just pick Binance or Yellow Card, two of the largest exchanges on the continent. There's quite a few others in Nigeria. A lot of Nigerian homegrown ones as well, like Busha. Also there's quite a few of them. So UX, you know, they're kind of solving for that now, in that, you know, centralized exchange, non-custodial wallets. There's other, custodial wallets, not, and then there's other non-custodials like Opera. So Opera has released MiniPay, which is a non-custodial wallet that is on Celo blockchain. using CUSD. So that's, and that, and their on-off-ramp is kind of, you know, done using P2P exchanges. So that those, that's kind of solving, I guess, the UX, not well, but they're making, you know, effort to that. The second you said is education. So centralized exchanges, Opera. So fun fact, Opera is the one of the, it's, I think it's the most ubiquitous browser in Africa, which is crazy to people who are outside of Africa, because everyone's like, yeah, Chrome and Safari. It's like, no. Chrome and Safari are data intensive. They need lots of data to run. Opera has really found a niche market in Africa for news, for browsing in general. So just a fun fact about that. But when it comes to education, Opera, Yellow Card, Binance, they have extensive UX. It's not only just like, you know, education website, but also in the, extensive education, on the, not just on the website or on the app, but also baked into the UX. They educate their users along the way. And then lastly, you mentioned, you know, regulation. Like, we're starting now to slowly see this come to life. Like I said, the regulation in Nigeria, regulators are paying very close attention. So would you, I don't know, I think I would argue that like centralized exchanges have to do that heavy lifting to drive mainstream adoption, but not only just centralized exchanges. I think also, which is why I work at a large, you know, payments gateway, like a large financial services institution, like a non-bank financial services institution, that, you know, is we have a reach that is so far and wide that we are hoping to move the needle slightly in by adopting crypto to do things like cross-border payments. And maybe on either end of the payment, it is fiat. But maybe that the cost of moving that fiat has gone down by, you know, a couple basis points, a couple percent. That is the goal. That's what we are trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do. But yeah, I think, like you said, all three of those things are going to have to work quite well together to realize this future.
Yeah, it's like having to build the wall, the mountain that you have to climb type of effort. But yeah, I hear you. Listen, we're approaching the end of our allotted time, and I wanted to open up for you to, you know, give your final messages and also to tell the audience where they can find you, where they can follow what you're doing on Afrique and everything else you do, because you're unstoppable.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess final closing note is Africa doesn't need crypto. Crypto needs Africa. Africa is truly, you know, on the grand scale right now, adoption and developer activity in comparison to the rest of the world is quite small still, but it is rapidly increasing. And coupled with our rapidly, massively increasing population, education rates, hunger for access to, you know, global markets, hunger for access to opportunity, I think that you know, Africa is a very interesting place. And, you know, 10 years from now, you know, I'm very confident that I'll be very happy that I doubled down on focusing on this region. So that's my closing statement. But where can you find me? I'm on X, formerly known as Twitter. Not Guerra, and then also Crypto at Scale, which is the podcast. And you can find some of the work we do at onafrique.com. Also at onafrique on Twitter as well.
Guerra, it's such a pleasure as always chatting with you, catching up to you, and actually getting to know a little bit more your background, your current thinking. And yeah, it's an honor to host you here for this Block Talks. And you know that the doors are always and forever open for you, my dear friend. Happy to have you. See you next time. Ciao. Catch us online. We're on Instagram at BlockDrops Podcast, on Twitter at BlockDrops Pod or Xerox Mauricio. We're on Lens at BlockDrops.Lens. We have a newsletter on LinkedIn. Write to us at blockdropspodcast@gmail.com, and you can listen to the Block Drops podcast at Spotify, iColab, Fabricum Tech, and all of the other major streaming platforms. Yay! Shh. Shout out to Guerra, who took time to share her incredible journey in crypto in the Global South with us. Don't forget to leave the ratings on your favorite player. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird, LFG.